From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Hollywood through the eyes of Joel Schumacher. He got his start as a costume director for Woody Allen movies, then he wrote the hit comedy Car Wash, and went on to direct St. Elmo's Fire, The Lost Boys, Batman Forever, Batman and Robin, Falling Down, 8mm, and two John Grisham adaptations, The Firm and A Time to Kill. He chose to make his latest movie a low-budget production with a cast of unknowns. It's called Tigerland, and it's about a platoon of men at boot camp training for Vietnam. The ups and downs of making blockbusters and low-budget movies, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton has reportedly failed in his effort to organize an emergency summit designed to end the crisis in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza. The Reuters news agency quotes a senior U.S. official as saying that none of the parties involved ruled out an eventual summit, but that leaders of Israel, the Palestinians, and Egypt haven't agreed that the talks would be productive right now. The president made a round of telephone calls to the leaders today. The report came as renewed violence broke out in the West Bank town of Ramallah, where Israeli troops fired rubber-coated bullets at stone-throwing Palestinian demonstrators. 12 days of clashes have left more than 80 people dead, most of them Palestinians and Israeli Arabs. Supporters of the new Yugoslav president Vojislav Koštunica made further progress today in taking away formal seats of power from the vestiges of the Slobodan Milošević regime. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Belgrade.
Zoran Đinđić, one of the leaders of the former opposition, announced today that the country's political parties agreed to disband the Serbian parliament and hold early elections on December 17th. Until then, Đinđić added, Serbia will be governed by a transitional cabinet formed by experts representing the entire political spectrum. Today, the powerful Serbian interior minister, who is in charge of the police, resigned, as did the Yugoslav federal prime minister, Momir Bulatović. The pro-democracy forces say their only pressure against the old guard is the threat of people power in the streets. There was a taste of it today when several thousand marching university students demanded annulment of draconian legislation passed last year, stifling freedom of speech in the media and in universities. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Belgrade.
NASA has put off the launch of its 100th space shuttle flight until tomorrow. It's the second delay in 5 days for the crew of the shuttle Discovery. The space agency postponed today's liftoff as 50-mile-per-hour winds gusted across the launch pad. Mechanical problems delayed last week's launch. NASA spokesman John Ira Petty says the crew took it easy today.
It's been a kind of a stand-down day for the crew. They've been kind of reviewing the meeting. They held a crew meeting. They've been reviewing their individual roles. They had a little bit of time with families. And so it was kind of a break.
Once the shuttle is in orbit, it's scheduled for an 11-day mission that includes work on the International Space Station. Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 28 points to close at 10,568. Declines led advances by 5-4 in light holiday trading of 717 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 5 points to close at 3,355. It was rebounding from a loss of nearly 130 points earlier in the day. This is NPR News. This year's Nobel Prize for Medicine will go to three researchers who study how the brain works. The nearly $1 million award will be shared by Paul Greengard of New York's Rockefeller University, Eric Kandel of Columbia University, and Arvid Carlson of Sweden. Colleagues praised the three neuroscientists for adding to the knowledge of how signals are communicated between nerve cells in the brain. The work of the three men is believed to shed light on the nature of memory and on the many kinds of mental illness. It feels more like winter than early fall over much of the country today, NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Record cold temperatures stretched from Minnesota into the deep south today. St. Cloud, Minnesota hit a low of 16, the coldest October 9th in more than a century there. In Albany, New York, apple pickers had to wait an hour for the frost to melt before they could start work this morning. The National Weather Service reports record lows in more than a dozen states, including Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Indiana, the Carolinas, and Texas. It was below freezing as far south as Huntsville, Alabama. And in New Orleans today, wind chills are dipping into the 30s and 40s. The cold air moved in over the weekend when it brought snow showers around the Great Lakes. A foot of snow fell on parts of northern Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Investigators from the Commonwealth Edison Power Company are looking into a power failure that left much of downtown Chicago in the dark yesterday. The six-hour power outage affected about 12,000 customers in Chicago's Loop, where darkened signal lights tied up traffic and the city's elevated and subway trains were stalled. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Joel Schumacher got his start in Hollywood as the costume director for Woody Allen's movies Sleeper and Interiors. He went on to write the hit comedy Car Wash and to direct St. Elmo's Fire, The Lost Boys, the John Grisham adaptations The Client and A Time to Kill, the blockbuster Batman Forever and its less successful sequel Batman and Robin. He directed Michael Douglas in Falling Down and Nicolas Cage in 8mm. But Schumacher opted to make his new film with a cast of unknowns and a small budget. It's called Tigerland, and it's set in 1971 at boot camp in Fort Polk, Louisiana. The young men know they're on their way to Vietnam, and most of them don't want to go. Matthew Davis plays Private Paxton, a budding writer. Private Boz, played by Colin Farrell, is unwilling to defer to authority and is hoping his defiance will get him thrown out of the military. In this scene, the platoon leader, played by Clifton Collins Jr., is warning Boz about his rebellious behavior.
Now, there ain't gonna be no more clowning from you, Boz. You hear? Now go wash up and hit the rack.
Oh, shit, you can't call him out. You're giving Cantwell a headache.
Now, I'm telling you, as your platoon guide, that's the same as getting an order from the sergeant. Don't make me put you on report, Boz.
It's matter, give it a rest. It's been a hard day for all of us, okay?
Don't you give me a hard time, too, Paxton. I mean, you're okay and all. You'll be a good soldier, but this sorry individual, he wants to put this whole platoon in the world to hurt.
Mater, what are you, 20 years old? Just because you wear those sergeant stripes don't mean you ain't gonna die, man, so just stuff it, okay?
Where you going that we ain't, huh, boss? You best start the soldiering, boy. But you was coming home in a rubber sack.
I asked Joel Schumacher if he was ever in the Army.
No, I was born in 1939, so I was too young, of course, for Korea, and getting a little old when Vietnam came around, but I also by then was shooting drugs about six times a day, so they took one look at me and were very happy for me to leave. I was a casualty of the 60s, but on the stateside.
Did they turn you away?
Yeah, they. I mean, I was such a drug addict that it was clear that I was not Army material. I mean, I was a shooting in the vein type of drug addict.
A heroin?
No, speed. Liquid methadrine.
And you had track marks and they saw it?
Mm-hmm. Well, and also my mind and body had not been connected for a long time. I mean, I was, if you saw me on the street, you would have gone, lucky to be here.
Well, this was kind of like the upside of being a drug user in a way. I mean, a lot of people who didn't want to go to Vietnam mutilated their bodies or tried to have, you know, public nervous breakdowns in order to get out of the war.
Or said they were gay. Some people, some heterosexual men tried to say they were gay, thinking that would make them 4F. And I guess it worked for a while until the Army caught on to that. So, yeah, remember, this was 1971. And by now, we had definitely been, you know, at the war too long. And the entire country was in a state of, you know, tumultuous confusion and violence over it, and so were families and people in neighborhoods, and so people were not clear really about why they were going or where they were going, and a lot of people didn't want to go and found different ways to get out of it. And as you mentioned, we even have a scene in the film which is taken from a friend of mine's experience where Colin Farrell and Matthew Davis, who play the leads, think perhaps they'll get drunk and break their legs and then they won't have to go.
But they can't go through with it.
No. It's very hard to break your limbs. Well, because the friend of mine, Brant Joel, who's now a successful CIA agent, was a hero in the Gulf War, but before he left for the Gulf, not expecting to be a hero, he and his best friend in the Marines decided to get drunk, and they would break their legs. And he said it's very difficult to actually break your limbs.
Well, the cast in Tigerland is really mostly unknown actors. Are there advantages, do you think, to working with actors who aren't stars and who aren't even known?
Yes, I've had a lot of experience with that, because in a lot of my earlier films, St. Elmo's Fire and Lost Boys and Flatliners, and even in The Client and A Time to Kill, I used unknowns in the lead. Matthew McConaughey in A Time to Kill, and Brad Renfro, the 10-year-old boy who did such a great job in The Client. And I've always enjoyed working with young people who are unknown, because it's a very exciting time in their lives. They haven't learned a lot of bad habits yet. Their whole careers are ahead of them. There's been no chance for any kind of cynicism or to look at the job as a gig in any way. And there is something very unique about working with people in their first job or their second job or their largest part they've ever had. That's very exciting, very inspiring. I can't say enough about this cast, because they worked under horrendous conditions and did it with a smile on their face, and were very good sports.
Are there ways in which stars are sometimes pampered and insulated to the extent that they become difficult to work with or even to communicate with?
Yes, I call it the hermaphrodite of Satyricon syndrome. There's a there's a film of Fellini's called Satyricon, which is about ancient Rome, his view of ancient Rome, and in it they worship this hermaphrodite who sort of lives in a sarcophagus surrounded by ravens that feed it, and they worship the hermaphrodite at 2, 4, 6, and 8, and its feet never touch the ground. And there are stars that are treated that way, you know. Please don't tell them about Bosnia. It might upset them. And yes, I don't think it's actually cloistering people to their own demise. You know, you're sort of encouraging them to death because they're not living in a real world. And it makes it very difficult for a director sometimes, because the studio, their agents, their managers, their publicists, their trainers, their chauffeurs, their chefs, their nannies, their makeup artists, their hairdressers, their masseurs, I'm sure I'm forgetting a few more in the entourage, the bodyguards, the therapists, the self-help guru, have insulated them in a bubble that is actually leading to their own destruction, because they're not living on the planet Earth. It's a form of Marie Antoinetteism that I don't agree with. Encourage.
You know, it's funny, because as a director of major motion pictures, you're inhabiting the same world that these stars are, but I don't think, because directors aren't that known by the public, I don't think they're quite as insulated as the actors are.
You can make your life that way if you want to be, because, you know, since Steven Spielberg's, incandescent, instant emergence on the industry, he's done more than anyone to really get the public to understand that there's someone behind the camera. So people like me, who in the 50s or 60s might not be a name that people know out there, a lot of people know who we are who make films. And so we get a lot of attention and have our own minor celebrity. So you have to be very cautious. The great Pauline Kael, who, as you know, was the great film critic for The New Yorker for decades, once wrote that Hollywood is a place where you can get encouraged to death. And it's easy to get used to, you know, corporate jets and limos. And I went through a period of that myself where I got a little lost because I had done 2 Grisham films that were very successful and 2 Batman films, and the first more successful than the second, but I had never planned on being the summer blockbuster king, and it was very good to me, very good to my bank account, very good to my old age, which is hovering as we speak, but the box office was starting to become more important than the movie. And when you become the home run king, there's just an enormous amount of pressure to just keep hitting home runs and not thinking about anything else. And it was pretty scary. And I found myself thinking I would never be one of those people. Slipping into it, you get used to it. I suddenly would look at a schedule, and I had next to my appointment handlers. There were suddenly people the studio have assigned to handle me, and I never thought I needed to be handled. I guess when I showed up at the 4F with the track marks, I needed handling, but that was a different kind of handling.
Joel Schumacher is my guest, and his new film, the new film he directed, is called Tigerland, and it's set at a boot camp in Louisiana in 1971. Some of his other films that he directed include St. Elmo's Fire, The Lost Boys, The Client, A Time to Kill, Batman Forever, and Falling Down. Now, in A Time to Kill, Matthew McConaughey was in the lead. And I remember when that movie was about to come out, there was so much hype about Matthew McConaughey. He was like in every magazine as the hot young actor that we have to watch, and he's so attractive and so on and so on. I thought, this is just too much. I don't care how good this guy is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how can anybody live up to this much hype? What was it like for you to watch that machine go into work? And
it was amazing. I had put the film together in a very rough cut. And we had shown it to a research audience, as we do before we finish a film, and we had enormously high marks and a very successful screening. And Bob Daly and Terry Semel, who were running Time Warner at that time, asked me if I would take it to New York in a rough stage and show it to the advanced press, magazines, essentially, because they have to deal with, you know, a long-range planning. You know, you have to get your stuff in months in advance or else you won't make it into the magazine. I took the film into New York, hoping just to get some attention on the film itself. When Graydon Carter at Vanity Fair and Ingrid Cishi at Interview and Linda Lee at the New York Times and some of the people at Newsweek and some of the other magazines, Rolling Stone, when they saw Matthew McConaughey, that was it. I mean, there was suddenly a huge fight over which cover he was going to be on, who was going to get to him first. Matthew didn't even have a publicist. We were not pushing him at all. We were just trying to get some press on the movie. And so what I watched was the press create this and then wake up the next morning and go, oh my, have we gone too far? We now ought to do articles about, has Matthew been hyped too much? When they did all the hyping. We did not have a publicity machine doing it. If you could create a star that way, believe me, every film and every studio would do it. But you can't. Only the audience really decides who a movie star is.
Yeah, I had assumed that there was a movie publicity machinery behind all that.
Yes, and we were even accused of that by the same people who had done it.
Hmm.
But that's okay. We're overpaid, overprivileged, over, you know, publicized, so we can take the hit.
My guest is director Joel Schumacher. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Joel Schumacher directed the new film Tigerland, as well as St. Elmo's Fire, The Client, A Time to Kill, 8mm, and Batman Forever. What are some of the unique pressures when you're making a blockbuster, particularly a summer blockbuster, like a Batman movie, and you have this really large budget that you are responsible for?
Yes, those are the only two large budget films I've ever made, Batman Forever and Batman and Robin. The budget is a small pressure compared to the tremendous burden of carrying one of the corporation's largest assets on your shoulder. Because when I was first offered the Batman franchise, Bob Daly said, we'd like to offer you the corporation's largest asset. And I thought he was joking. I thought it was a sort of charming way to get into offering me a movie. And I said jokingly, what, are you going to give me Mel Gibson? And, you know, that's great. I'll set him up as a gynecologist in Beverly Hills, and and we'll make so much money we can buy Time Warner. But they weren't kidding at all, because what I soon found out, and I just told this to a young director who would like to be considered for the next Batman movie, and he asked me what my advice was, and I said, listen, I think you're a brilliant young director, and I think you'll do a great job, but making the movie is not the job. The job will be feeding, you know, the kitty, and the kitty is a very big kitty. You're supporting the Warner Brothers stores, all of the licensees, all of the ancillary rights, Walmart, the Kmart, the fast food franchises, Kenner Toys, Sega Games, Acclaim. There are thousands and thousands of items that are made with the Batman logo on them. DC Comics you're helping to support, and you're feeding that enormous machine, and that is really what the job is, and everyone has very, very, very high expectations. After Batman Forever was the most profitable and successful film of that year, I believe it was 95, yeah, then 2 years later we were expected to top it, and that was when things began to burn out for me, because by then I realized that I was really opening toy stores in Sydney, Australia. I was not making movies anymore. I was the doll king. I might as well be on QVC. And it wasn't a bad experience, but it was a very enlightening one, and I needed to move on.
How does the anxiety of all the people who hold who are going to be selling the ancillary products, how does their anxiety get communicated to you, the director?
Well, I'm Batman Forever because everyone felt that Batman Returns had been a disappointment. That was Tim Burton's second foray into it, and nobody bought the merchandise, and it was considered a failure. So they wanted to reinvent the franchise, and so people were very wary and skeptical of us. So in the first Batman, we were kind of begging people to take a chance on us. What happened was the movie became such a surprising hit, and everyone made so much money that when Batman and Robin came along, then they expected to make a great deal of money. So the way that works is they come and see you. You have board meetings. They tell you... There's a word that I learned called toyetic. They want to know if the movie is toyetic enough. That means, are you going to sell enough toys with the movie? Are you going to have enough? Are you going to have enough vehicles? Enough trucks? Enough this? You know, when Walmart comes to purchase, they buy things in the hundreds of thousands of dozens. I'd never heard of numbers like that. You know, and that means one item like Batman pajamas. So they're looking to the movie really as a starting point for sales. And they have concerns about the children's market. You know, will the film be too dark? Will it be too adult? Will it be too sexual? Will it be too violent? Because, you know, can you sell a Happy Meal if the film is not happy? You know, I mean, it's, you know, you're in the advertising business. And it was fun in the sense that I learned a great deal. It stopped being fun after a while. And then there are people who want to get in. Can you put in, you know, a Visa card? Can Batman carry a Visa card? And then they'll offer a lot of money. So suddenly, you know, a lot of the top executives at the studio are saying, Joel, can't you find a scene that you can put in a Visa card? You know, the card is definitely starting to run the horse.
So tell me more how product placement works in movies.
Well, it's become less and less because the audience has gotten really
too hip to it.
And also, there are a lot of stars that are too hip to it. And so, in other words, you know, if Julia Roberts is going to be sitting at a bar drinking a name beer, why aren't they paying her? You know, why should she advertise a beer just because they're going to throw some money at the studio?
Right.
They're actually using her image then to promote something that maybe in real life she is not a fan of, you know, or doesn't want to be seen promoting.
The first Batman movie that you made, Batman Forever, was a big hit. The second one you made, Batman and Robin, didn't do as well. That was the one with George Clooney.
Right.
So what were some of the rewards of having, you know, a huge success and some of the consequences of doing a follow-up that didn't meet expectations?
Actually, the biggest rewards were on the one that didn't meet the expectations, because when you have a huge success like Batman Forever, you actually don't know quite what you've done. It sort of feels like an accident, and you're very happy, you're very high from the experience, and everybody's screaming and yelling and sending you things. And, you know, we had the biggest opening weekend in history, and Warner Brothers had a party, and you're happy. But the first film I ever had big success with was a very small movie called Car Wash, which I didn't direct. Michael Schultz directed, but I wrote it. And it was one of these tiny little movies that cost $750,000. It came out in 1977, and I think the album alone made $8 million or something. And it just became one of those little movies that, you know, hit a nerve, hit a chord, and became a hit. And I remember riding in my car and pressing buttons on the radio, and the Car Wash song was on every radio station. But when you have success in the movies, it's always happening outside somewhere. It's in movie theaters and with strangers that you don't know. It's on radio stations that you're not connected with. It's, you know, you've done something right, but it's very intangible because it's happening out there, and you either hit that zeitgeist or you don't. So it's very hard to learn from success, I find. It's a lot easier to learn from the disappointments, because then you can analyze things. And for me, I had gotten a little wound up in the machine. I was starting to think like the marketing people. I was getting a lot of awards for selling the most Batman figures ever and things like that. And I was losing focus. You know, Harry Knowles, who's on the web with Ain't It Cool, and sort of is an outlaw who reviews movies too early and things like that. A lot of people have problems with him, but I like Harry. What he wrote about Batman and Robin and me is, Joel Schumacher's a good director, but someone needs to smack him. when he wrote that on his website, a lot of journalists called me up and wanted me to, you know, to comment on that. And I think they were hoping for some kind of verbal confrontation. And I said, he's right. I understand exactly what he means. I needed to get back in the subways of New York, where I grew up on the streets of New York. I needed to start walking again. I need to start being a real person.
Joel Schumacher directed the new movie Tigerland. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications. BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of 1863, The Rebirth of a Nation, A History of a Year in America's Past by Joseph E. Stevens, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, film director Joel Schumacher tells us about growing up in Queens, New York, across the street from a movie theater, becoming acquainted with drugs and sex before reaching his teenage years, and the unusual path he took to Hollywood. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Joel Schumacher. He directed such films as St. Elmo's Fire, The Lost Boys, Batman Forever, The Client, A Time to Kill, Falling Down, and 8mm. His new movie, Tigerland, is a low-budget film with a cast of unknowns about young men in boot camp in 1971 preparing to fight in Vietnam. I want to ask you about some other recent news that you created, which is that you came out, it was, I think, sometime in the past year. Yes?
No, I've never been in.
Never been in? Okay.
Never been in.
But it became more public?
No, I think...
Someone told me? Is that what it was?
No. I mean, I've been... my life's sort of been an open book since birth. I'm one of those street kids who started drinking at 9, drugs in my early teens, sex when I was 11, you know, smoking when I was 10. I'm one of those people. And... certainly have had a very sexual life, which we probably won't go into because we don't have enough tape. But but I've never hidden anything about my life and always assumed everybody knew everything about me, since I've certainly, you know, done everything on the planet Earth except murder somebody. And I hope in my drug haze I didn't. But... So I think there is an obsession with labels, however, and I'd really like to talk about that because I'm very against any form of labeling. I think as long as we're part of a culture that finds it necessary to say, you know, gay actor, black judge, you know, female advocate, you know, Jewish prime minister, then we are all contributing to the notion that the only norm is a Caucasian, heterosexual, WASP male. Because no one who are those things are ever referred to as that. So as long as we keep labeling each other as gay or lesbian or black or Asian or Jewish or whatever we want to say about each other, then I think we all promote that myth that the only norm is what I mentioned before. And so I'm very against labels completely. I'm a man. I'm a citizen of the United States and happy to be, and I'm a movie director. And what I do in the bedroom, I would assume, is of absolutely no interest to anybody on the planet Earth.
Now, all that said, did people in the industry know, and was it ever held against you in any way? Do you ever feel
if
that?
If anything has ever been held against me, I'm not aware of it. Mm-hmm. In other words, I do think sometimes I'm asked if there's homophobia in Hollywood. Well, there's homophobia on the planet Earth, as there is anti-Semitism and sexism and racism, unfortunately. And I don't think there'll be an end to those things in our lifetime. They don't get checked at the gate at the movie studio. People who work in the movie business have the same feelings as people do all over the globe. The difference in show business is, if you can make money for people, they don't care what you do. They don't care if you screw yaks in the middle of the street. They'll even buy you the yak. They'll give you their yak. So if I've ever been denied access anywhere in the world because of, you know, who I am in any way, I'm not aware of it.
I have a very important question for you. As the director of 2 Batman movies, you must be familiar with the Saturday Night Live cartoon sketch of the ambiguously gay duo, where it's Batman and Robin,
yeah,
and they're dressed in their tights, and everything
right.
they're doing is so gay, except
right.
they don't get it. They don't realize that
right.
everything they're
right.
doing is so gay. Everything's like a phallic symbol, and they're these like tight tights. And so as the gay director of 2 Batman movies, what do you like? What do you think of the sketch?
Well, I am the director of the
yes,
2
I know,
Batman
right.
movies.
And you happen to
right.
be gay. Yes, right. Thank
right.
you.
Well, I certainly had a lot of mischief with it, but with Batman and Robin, the myth that that it's all homoerotic and it's all homosexual happened long, long before any of us came along. That was in the '50s, mm-hmm. and it was written in a book, and I think it was by oh gosh, I can't remember his name, where I used to have this down pat when I had to do all the press junkets, but he wrote this famous book, which is absurd, and taking all the childhood idols and breaking it down. You know, Snow White means you hate your mother and want to kill her. You know, he put it all into this very armchair Freudian, you know, pop sort of sensibility. And Batman and Robin was the essence for him of homoeroticism and homosexuality, because there were these two single men living in a cave. Ever since he wrote that book, which has been quoted and overanalyzed to death, there's been this thing about Batman and Robin. And so, you know, so I had a lot of fun with it. Since you always get asked if that's the case with them, I thought, well, I might as well play it up to somewhat. And I over-exaggerated all the sexuality in my Batman movies. You know, the men and the women are sort of over-steroided sexually, mm-hmm. because I thought it was better to play into it than try to pretend it wasn't there.
My guest Joel Schumacher directed the new film Tigerland, as well as St. Elmo's Fire, The Client, A Time to Kill, 8mm, and Batman Forever. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Joel Schumacher is my guest, and the new movie he directed is called Tigerland. Now, it sounds like everything you've been saying, that you were doing drugs, having sex, and involved in all kinds of mayhem before I was allowed to even take the bus or the train by myself. So how did you end up with this, lively and kind of dangerous life at such a young age?
My father died when I was 4. My mother was out at work 6 days a week and 3 nights a week to support us. It was just my mother and me. And I grew up in a relatively poor neighborhood in Long Island City, right over the 59th Street Bridge, which was basically factories and tenement-like buildings. And I was on the street. You know, by the time I was 7, I had a bicycle, and so I was wild in the streets, and I had no parental supervision. Some of the women in the neighborhood who hung out of the windows on their pillows, you know, their elbows resting on the pillows, would try to discipline me. They found that to be a futile attempt. And I was just a kid in the streets, and that's not unusual. If you were to go into a rough and, unprivileged neighborhood right now, anywhere, you would find street kids that start everything very young. It's the way you prove yourself to be a man in an environment like that. The sooner you start drinking, smoking, and having sex, the sooner you become a man. And I'm sure it's that way today in many cultures.
Were you still going to school while you were doing this?
Oh, sure. I graduated from high school a little early because I was a problem in school, so they skipped me a couple of grades, because in those days they thought if they gave you harder work to do, you would behave. That was a mistake. That was just an encouragement for me.
You took a kind of interesting route to get to Hollywood. I don't know if you
never
intended
to
get to Hollywood.
There.
Yeah,
never knew I was going to get there.
You started off, I think, like dressing windows for department stores.
Yes.
I
started out working for the butcher when I was 9. Uh-huh. I started delivering meat, and then my mother worked in a dress store selling dresses, and there was a bookstore next door run by what was called then a beatnik. Her name was Irene, and she wore black stockings and, you know, liked jazz. And she was an intellectual and an egghead, and her windows were a mess, and so she let me pile books up in the window at 9, and once a month I could pick a book, and that was my payment. So I sort of started working doing windows, and never expecting to get to Hollywood. I grew up behind a movie theater before television, which is probably another thing you can't imagine. And
well, there's a movie theater right across the way from your house?
Right across the way. I could see the door, the back doors, the fire doors of the theater from the little apartment my mother and I lived in. It was right across the street, facing the empty lot where my baseball team that I was part of. We played baseball, so I was either causing mayhem or in the movies causing mayhem. And I loved the movies. I was like the little kid in Cinema Paradiso that my mother had to drag me out of there. I would watch the same movies over and over and over again, and was always obsessed with them. Hollywood was a long way away in those days, and I had to make money because I had a Jack and the Beanstalk kind of life. You know, I had to sell the cow to get some money for my mother and me. So I had to go out and work at a very early age, which it was my pleasure to do, sort of. And I had gotten myself through art school and won a lot of awards and had worked my way up to doing the windows and the interiors at Bendel's, which was a very important store in New York at that time. I worked for a great boss, Jerry Stutz. And, you know, I also wanted the beautiful people life. When I was a kid, I would, you know, look at magazines and newspapers, see people dressed up going to parties, and I wanted to be those people because I thought people who got dressed up and went to parties were happy people. I have since changed my mind about that. So I wanted the beautiful people life, and I got it. I got it really young, and all the consequences that come with the fast lane.
You did costume design on movies like Sleepers and Interiors, two Woody Allen movies, before you started writing or directing movies.
Right.
Did your work doing store windows lead to costume design?
When I got out of art school, I started, I went into fashion because everybody said, if you go into fashion, Joel, you'll make a lot of money. And when I heard make a lot of money, that equated my mother. I could get her a new apartment. The minute I started to make money in the fashion world, my mother died suddenly. By then, I was a drug addict, and I used the money to just, you know, shoot it up and burn out. But when I got off hard drugs, which is in 1970, I still had a name in the fashion world, certainly as a crash and burn victim, but I certainly had a name. And Dominic Dunn, who is now a very successful novelist, was a producer then. He gave me my first job in the movies, and that happened because when I got off shooting up, when I got off hard drugs in 1970, I thought, I've got to go back to basics, and I've really screwed up my life here. So what can I do to make my life better? And I thought, I've got to pursue my original dream as a child to become a movie director. And I met Dominic Dunn through mutual friends, and he was producing a film called Play It As It Lays. I stalked him, and he gave me a job as a costume designer because I'd had a reputation in fashion of being some kind of wunderkind, which I wasn't. I was just a drug wunderkind. And I did that film and then got a lot of work doing costumes. Sleeper with Woody Allen was my fourth movie. Woody changed my life. I learned a great deal watching him direct because it was a very open forum. We were encouraged to bring our ideas. It was like the high school play. I had worked for three very tyrannical autocrats before that and thought that's the way directors directed movies. With Woody, it was a wonderful, open family experience where we were encouraged to do our best work and therefore did it. I realized you could be that kind of director. And he also encouraged me to pursue my dream of becoming a director.
So when you started doing costumes for movies, you worked on two Woody Allen movies, Sleeper and Interiors. Sleeper is a futuristic film that's set 200 years in the future. And Interiors was a very realistic movie that was about a family with a lot of problems. So talk a little bit about doing the costumes for two such different kinds of films for the same director.
Well, the punishment always suits the crime. You know, I mean, the content should always dictate form. So it's the same with costumes. I like to do what I call invisible art direction in the sense that even when it's visible, it's enhancing the story so that you're never making the costume or the set the star. You're making the story the star. You want to sell the story. But the way I did Interiors, it's everything is in gray and beige and brown until Maureen Stapleton comes in and she's in red.
Right, I remember the red dress, yeah.
Yeah, and she's really the symbol of life, and that's just a trick. Mm-hmm. It's just a trick that you do everything monotone and bring in something red. I use the same trick in Sleeper. Everything in Sleeper is black, white, and gray, and the police are all in scarlet. So it just gives you a sort of emotional hook to feel a mood change in a movie.
No, a movie that really helped make your career was Car Wash. You wrote the script. It became a huge hit, even though it was a fairly low-budget film. It had a great cast. I mean, the cast included Richard Pryor, Garrett Morris, Antonio Fargas, George Carlin, Ivan Dixon, who was in Nothing But a Man, Professor Alan Corey, the Pointer Sisters. One of the things that's interesting about this is that it's a predominantly African-American cast. You're a white person writing it for them. That was probably, and I don't think it was very common to have movies then with such a large African-American cast. I think there were far fewer movies with predominantly black casts then. So tell me a little how the story came to you.
Well, the first script I wrote was Sparkle, which is also about three African-American sisters in Harlem who, it was sort of a forerunner to Dreamgirls, and I'd always been in love with rhythm and blues and with the early days of soul music, and so the first script I wrote was about that. And when people read it in Hollywood, they said, "Oh, Joel, you've written a black movie." And I had never heard that. Speaking of labeling, Terry, I'd never heard that. I said, "Oh, so Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is a white movie, but we don't refer to it as that." And so people are afraid of black movies. Sparkle got made for a very little budget, and it's still a cult hit, I'm happy to say. But then when I wrote Car Wash, that is called a crossover movie, and that means a movie with black people in it that white people go to see. So I wrote a crossover movie. The idea for Car Wash came from Art Linson and Gary Stromberg, two strung-out record company execs at the time who wanted to do a stage play where they built a car wash and had a big singing, dancing musical in the car wash. And Ned Tannen, who ran Universal, said, "That's the worst idea I've ever heard in my life, but maybe there's a movie in a car wash, and maybe you could get Joel Schumacher, who's just written this movie Sparkle, to write it." And when they asked me to do it, I had just driven downtown L.A. one Sunday morning to meet friends for breakfast, and I passed a car wash that was closed, and there was an African-American street hooker, early in the morning with a blonde wig on, in a phone booth, trying to make a phone call, very strung out, with a beer in a paper bag. And when they said, "Do you want to write a movie about a car wash?" I said, "Yes," based on that image. And the director, Michael Schultz's wife, Lauren Jones, played that hooker in the movie. And the rest, as they say, Terry, is history.
Now, the soundtrack recording of this was very successful, too. Did you write in to your script the records that were used, or did they have to substitute other records because they couldn't afford to license the ones you'd chosen?
No, they were all written for the, well, I'm sure when I wrote it, because I wrote it so long ago in the mid-70s, I don't know if I wrote, I probably wrote real songs in, but the producers, Art and Gary, did a brilliant thing. They got Norman Whitfield, who had done a lot of the stuff for the Supremes and the Four Tops and the Temptations at Motown, had just left Motown, and they got him. And what Norman did was, it's almost like an opera. Every song in Car Wash has to do with what's happening in the scene that it's playing in. So if you listen to the lyrics, it's always about what's going on the screen. And, because of telemarketing, I still see the songs advertised all the time, and people are still doing cover records on them, and they're still selling the old records.
Did you write any of the lyrics?
No, but they are taken from the content of the scenes.
My guest is film director Joel Schumacher. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is Joel Schumacher. He directed the new movie, Tigerland. Some of the other films he directed include St. Elmo's Fire, The Lost Boys, The Client, A Time to Kill, Batman Forever, and Falling Down, Flawless, Any Millimeter. One last question. You grew up across the street from a movie theater. Mm-hmm. Is there any movie or two that really changed your life in some way that you fell in love with so much you had to keep going to the movies?
Well, there were tons of them. I remember there were 2 weeks that I cut school every afternoon to see Picnic with Kim Novak and William Holden.
Mm-hmm.
There was something about that dancing scene. And
that's some pretty strange dancing in that scene.
It's terrible.
I know.
It's absolutely terrible. And it's really not a very good movie. And Kim Novak was not the greatest actress, but my friends and I, we were just obsessed with Kim Novak. I've always been, you know, a lot of times, I did a big interview last year for Movie Line that Michael Fleming did, and his editor's question was, the name of the article, the title of the article was, why do people look sexier in a Joel Schumacher movie than in their other movies? And that's how I see people. I grew up on, you know, Marilyn Monroe, Kim Novak, Elizabeth Taylor, Marlon Brando, Montgomery Clift, James Dean. And when you went to the movie, Paul Newman, when you went to the movies, that's what Audrey Hepburn, Grace Kelly, that's what movie stars looked like. And, you know, I'm still from that. Great Expectations was the film I saw when I was 7, not knowing who Dickens, David Lean, or Great Expectations was, but my father had died a few years before that, and it begins with a little boy, Pip, skipping through a graveyard, which was an, you know, I had never seen an image that I could relate to more in my life at that time than a little boy in a graveyard alone. And then the convict, the famous scene where the convict jumps out from behind the gravestone and changes his life, because he also offers him the opportunity to a life of bright lights, big city, and beautiful people in London at that time. So the whole film changed my life. It also made me want to make whatever was happening on the screen. Very shortly after that, I went to the library near our school, and I got books on marionettes, and I built a marionette theater and marionettes, and I started giving shows. And I think, and I wrote the scripts, and I played music on my little wind-up phonograph and made the costumes and the sets. And I really think I was making movies. I think I was starting to make movies because of Great Expectations. So that was one that stayed with me. It still does.
Did the movie theater itself have any magic, or was it a pretty run-down theater, or what?
No, they built this. Well, I mean, we're talking about in the mind of a child now. So, I mean, in my mind, it was the Arabian Nights. It was a huge. Well, they did build huge movie palaces, even in poor neighborhoods, because, of course, what better way to? There were only two buildings of glamour in our neighborhood: the Catholic Church, which was St. Sebastian's, which was also filled with magic and theater, and the movie theater. I like that theater better. And because I could understand what they were saying. And the, you know, there were little twinkling stars in the ceiling, and there were sort of Arabian Nights tableaus painted on the side and velvet curtains. And, you know, I'm sure with the lights on, it was all pretty shabby and tacky. But in my memory, it was so exciting. And what made it even more exciting was there was no ratings on movies in those days. There were either movies at the Catholic Church banned or didn't ban, and of course I only wanted to see the ones they banned. And the way the movies worked on a Saturday, for instance, was they would have 20 cartoons in the morning, and then 2 westerns, and then they would have their features, a double feature in the afternoon, and then at night they would have the adult band movies like Streetcar Named Desire and I would stay there all day, and when it came time for the band movies, I would go in the men's room, this huge men's room, and I would stand up on the toilet seat and crouch down and hide and hope they wouldn't find me. And then I'd slither back into the movie theater and try to find an adult to sit next to. And sometimes the adults ratted on us, but sometimes you could get away with it.
So sometimes you were thrown out?
Yes, there was a matron in a white uniform with a flashlight, and she was always some tough Irish broad that your mother knew, and she'd come down and grab you by the ear and say, Joel Schumacher, I'm going to tell your mother, and when your mother comes home from work, she's going to crown you.
What did your mother think about you cutting school and going to the movies, or seeing the movies that the church had banned?
My mother was from Sweden. She was very tall, very beautiful, and a consummate lady, and I'm sure I broke her heart. My mother was constantly in tears, looking at me, saying, darling, what am I going to do with you? You know, she would say, you know, one of the women in the neighborhood would try to discipline me while she was at work, and I'd say, you know, the F word to you, Mrs., O'Hara. And then my mother would come home and she'd sit down. My mother was such a lady. And she'd say, now, darling, Mrs. O'Hara said, you said dirty words to her today. And I would say, Mom, Mrs. O'Hara's a liar.
Oh, gee.
She's so fat and ugly and you're so beautiful and she's jealous of you. And my mother would say, darling, I don't know who to believe. And I'd say, believe me, Mom. She says, so, I mean, my mother's life. I wish she had, I could really treat her like a queen now. I wish she had live, but that wasn't meant to be.
Well, she'd surely be very proud of you now.
I hope so.
Joel Schumacher, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Terry. I really appreciate this.
Joel Schumacher directed the new movie Tigerland. His other films include St. Elmo's Fire, The Client, A Time to Kill, Batman Forever, and 8mm. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Some of the work gets kind of hard. This ain't no place to be if you plan on being a star. Let me tell you, it's always cool. And the boss don't mind sometimes if you act a fool. At the car wash, oh, 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 oh. Talking about the car wash, yeah. Come on, y'all, and sing it for me.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Expanded Quotable Einstein, available in bookstores or online at www.pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we welcome back Stephen King and discuss the car accident that nearly killed him and what it was like to experience the kind of pain he had only imagined for his fiction. King has a new book about writing. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.